This is The Thirsty Developer, episode number 49, for Monday, January 26th, 2009, Silverlight plus Twitter. This week we have an interview with Steve Holstead of Clarity Consulting in downtown Chicago. Steve has built a Silverlight-based front-end to the Twitter platform. Let's listen to the interview. Hi, this is Larry, and I'm in downtown Chicago today. I've run into my old friend, Steve Holstead. Steve, can you say hi to the folks?
How you doing, everybody?
Steve, you work with Clarity Consulting. You're a consultant, and you've got a little side project going on right now that I'd love to talk to you about.
Definitely. I've been here about 4 years, and sometimes when we don't have client work, we end up having bench time, and they kind of do a good job of letting you do whatever you'd like. And about a year ago, I figured I wanted to really get into the Silverlight piece. That's something that really interested me. And I'd just gotten into Twitter. So at the time I checked around, there weren't really any Silverlight Twitter clients out there being used. And so things like Snitter and TweetDeck, they were things like that were around. But as I moved to different client sites and things like that, you know, you don't always want to put software onto a machine. So I figured Silverlight might be a good fit for that.
So let's talk about, you know, first of all, let's give people the URL where they can go look at this. You know, if they're sitting at their desk, again, if you're in the car, please don't pull over. It's twitterlight.claritycon.com.
Absolutely.
And, of course, we'll have that in the show notes. If you go to thirstydeveloper.com, look at the episode page. So this is you need the Silverlight runtime environment. If you don't have it, it'll prompt you. It'll install it.
Yep.
You know, this is a Twitter client. Now, you could go to the website for Twitter and you could get, you know, all this exact same information. But what you've done is you've used the Silverlight platform to kind of, you know, make the interface pop a little, right?
Absolutely. Yes. It's much more interactive too. The Twitter site's fine. I think it's very dry and not interesting. And I wouldn't sit on that all day. So this is more auto-updating and it's got some nice animation effects. It's really easy to follow and leave people.
Yeah, so let's first of all, let's get you a few more Twitter followers. What's your Twitter handle?
Steve Holstead.
So twitter.com/Steve Holstead. Everybody run out there and follow him and tell him you saw him on the Thirsty Developer or heard him on the Thirsty Developer. But let's talk about this is kind of a double header. Because, you know, when I saw your most recent updates to it and you sent me an email saying, hey, you know, I've done some updates to Twitterlight based on people's feedback. This is kind of a double header because I'd like to talk about developing for Twitter. And then also talk about Silverlight.
Sure.
Can we start with the Twitter piece of it?
Absolutely.
So Twitter has an API that they've exposed for developers, you know, with a Rust-based interface. And most .NET developers, and I think that primarily the people listening to this show are .NET developers, they're familiar with classic ASMX web services or WCF web services. One of the new features of WCF is actually to expose itself as REST. But if you look at popular sites on the internet, Flickr, Twitter, you know, they've all got REST-based interfaces. Tell us, you know, in real quick, what's Steve's definition of a REST-based interface, or how does it work?
Well, how it works to me is it's just a really free-flowing, open service that we can receive things back in XML, in JSON. I think they have RSS and Atom now too. And it's just a really nice way to write in any kind of technology and pull back live information, which always makes the application so much more exciting.
Yeah, and traditional web services are very interoperable. They work across platforms, but you generally need some kind of client proxy. The nice thing about REST is it's all URL and, you know, HTTP based. So you can actually literally open your browser and you can do a REST call.
Yes.
So you can say twitter.com, you know, /public timeline, and then you can append. Normally that's the web page, but you can append some additional information, say, hey, I'd like that public timeline in an XML or JSON feed, right?
Yep, absolutely. And some of them are public, or you can go look at right now in a browser. Some take some basic authentication.
Yeah, and Twitterlight, if you actually just go to the client that you built, you know, by default, it's going to show you the public feed, which requires no authentication. But you've got a user ID password box where somebody can actually log on, and then they'll get, you know, the private side of the feed, right?
Yep, exactly. And then you can do all the full Twitter interactions that everybody's used to. One of the new features I put in finally was to store those encrypted and isolated storage. Something I wanted to play with a little bit and just never found the time in the past.
So from a credential standpoint, just so everybody's comfortable with this, if you put your user ID and password into the password box, you know, it's not being stored in Steve's personal web server or anything like that. It's actually stored in an isolated storage. So let's jump to Silverlight real quick.
Okay.
What's isolated storage?
Isolated storage is Silverlight runs within a sandbox. And they've given us isolated storage as a spot that's, it's going to be different on most machines, but it's a spot that we can drop information, persist information that we can pull back at a future time. So credentials for Twitter is a perfect opportunity to store your username, and then read it back out whenever we want it.
And you mentioned the sandbox. It's isolated from the browser. It's isolated from other applications on the machine. It's, and hence the name isolated. Come on, Larry. You know, it's a protected area of the machine that the Silverlight runtime has access to. If I log on to the same machine, go to the same application, I'm not going to have access to those credentials because I've logged in with a different profile, right?
Yep. Exactly. Yeah,
so it's, I like to, when I'm talking to people about it, it's like, think of it as, you know, cookies on steroids or super cookies.
Sure.
Because it doesn't have a lot of the limitations that a cookie does about file size and file types and all that.
Right. And we now have the ability to ask for more size, more capacity, which is wonderful. So if we ever wanted to store a history of your last month's tweets, we could ask for a larger file size and start writing those out into your isolated storage.
Right. So you can get some interactivity in the client itself. Now it is, you know, we should note that it is somewhat volatile because if the profile is deleted on the machine, it's not being stored on a server somewhere. So,
yep.
You know, but it, you know, clearing your cache doesn't get rid of isolated storage, right?
Right.
So cool. So let's talk about, how did you get started actually developing against the REST API? You know, because that's the thing is that once you master that, I mean, pretty much all of Twitter is just a variation on the basic REST call.
Right. Absolutely. Once you kind of parse out the XML structure, whatever you do, you're going to get back that same structure for the most part. Some of them are slightly different. Like the direct messages come back a little different. But basically, if you can read public feeds, you can read private feeds, and you can read your favorites and all that. So really, we're just getting back an XML string and parsing out the pieces we care about.
Well, that was one of my questions for you is that, you know, because Twitter lets you specify your different format feeds, mm-hmm. you're using the XML. Real quick, why XML versus JSON, you know?
Just a personal preference for me. I've used XML for years and years.
You're an angle bracket guy.
Yeah, I am.
You had the mad skills in angle brackets. And I think that a lot of people, you know, they overreach the fact that, well, JSON's so much smaller. You know, it is smaller, you know, and if you looked at, you know, the huge amount of traffic, you know, that's going to add up over time. But if you look at the average JSON feed, it's 20 to 40% less than the XML.
Yep.
The problem is that you don't have as rich of a tool set, you know, in parsing and things like that.
Yep.
So your parsing, did you create your own little Twitter parser library? Did you borrow somebody's?
No, I did. We created it from scratch. And what's another thing that's beautiful about the REST piece is, just to ping that in a browser, you can see the response, which makes it so much easier to just look at and get a visual idea of what you're trying to do. So then the parsing engine with the XML reader and all that kind of writes itself.
And did you, you know, so you actually created, you know, a Steve, you know, Holstead library, you know, that you actually pushed down with your Silverlight client?
Yep, included in the Zap.
Okay, so it's actually in the Zap. And I was going to ask, and how did you find XML handling in the Silverlight runtime versus the full .NET framework?
You know, I didn't notice much of a difference at all. Obviously, it's a subset of the pieces we care about, the XML reader and the XML reader settings, no issues.
That's so cool. Love to hear that.
The beauty of Silverlight, right, is that we can leverage our .NET skills and do something kind of new and cutting edge with things we've already done in the past 3 years ago.
I guess I should ask the contentious question, C-sharp or VB?
C-sharp.
All right. You're one of those squiggly bracket kind of guys, huh?
I am. I came up a VB guy, and I made the switch. Put away childish things, and I was...
Oh, God, you're hurting me, Steve. I got to tell you, I try to do as much in C-sharp as possible, you know, to make the leap. But I'm old school VB, going back to like VB4, you know. I still find myself when I'm doing C#, you know, doing the objects in the wrong order. I'm like, why isn't this working? You know, because you gotta say string my string. You don't say dim. You know my.
Exactly.
You know it's completely the opposite.
It's funny when we were at for clarity. You know, you don't know what project you're going to be on 6 months from now, and obviously we switch back and forth, and so you have to suffer through that 1 week of writing like Spanglish version code that doesn't really work. It's like you're mixing up your keywords.
Yeah. There's a little hint. I think I saw Don Box do this years ago, that if you have to do VB as a C# guy, that at the end of every line, put a comment and then put a semicolon at it, you'll just feel better.
Really?
The compiler will ignore it because it's a comment. So
it's genius.
Yeah. Okay, so you've got your own, you know, little library to do your parsing, so you understand the Twitter feeds. What's nice about that is that, you know, that if the feed were to change, you go change the one library and your client will still work.
Yes.
I've seen the application several times. You know, you've got XAML doing a lot of the work for you, right?
Right.
Because it looks like you probably parsed the XML, created an object, and then you bound it to some XAML. Is that how you did that?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yes and no. So what we do is, The Twitter piece is actually pretty simple on this. Once you're used to it and get the XML string back and you parse it out, that's really it. At that point, though, we have common controls. We have really one tweet control. So if you see the app, there's going to be 25 instances come up, one per tweet. Really, all we're doing is looping through our responses and mapping fields that we care about into public properties in our common control.
Okay.
And then our XAML is bound to that to, of course, display that on the screen. So really what you're looking at is 25 to 500 instances of a XAML control being loaded and dropped into a panel.
Yeah, and one of the cool things about the app is that I love a web application that scales with my screen size, because I've actually got the laptop that I carry around is a 13-inch, you know, monitor. It's a nice, it's a good-looking screen, but it's kind of small. And then at home, I have like this behemoth 24-inch wide screen.
Yep.
I want my web apps to take advantage of whatever I give it.
Exactly.
Whether it's the 13-inch or whether it's the behemoth, right? And what's nice about Twitter Lite is that you pretty much butt up right up against the edge of whatever monitor. Right,
absolutely. And that's one of the biggest features I had people mention, is that some people want the full screen. Like, I've gone home and put it on my LCD TV, and like, it's just wonderful to see that much real estate being rewarded. We also have people who want to squish it down to one column, which is kind of nice, because if you're sitting and you have other things you're working on, this isn't something you're going to sit and watch actively all day, but sometimes it's nice to just have it in one little corner so you can see the latest 5 or 6 or whatever space you have.
Yeah, so, and again, just in case somebody's like screaming at the podcast, you know, with this question, I'll go ahead and address the fact that there's plenty of Twitter clients out there.
Yes.
Matter of fact, I mean, there's a couple of dozen pretty good ones. You specifically, you know, did this because you wanted it to run in the browser. You wanted the advanced graphics features, you know, the vector scaling, but you didn't want to have a big footprint from an application standpoint on the machine.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly right.
So you basically, you know, created a snitter or twirl or whatever that could run within Silverlight in the browser. And fundamentally, you did this, you know, to do your mad skills. It's not, because we know we're going to get an email from somebody saying, well, he could have used this other client that already existed.
Oh, absolutely. And it's funny. I use probably 5 different clients at times with my phone and you name it, like wherever you are or whatever's convenient you're going to use. So this is by no means end all be all. It's just something that I'm not a great book learner.
Right.
So to learn some new technology, I really need to get my hands dirty. This kind of just took off on its own from a little proof of concept to something I really enjoyed, and we actually have a decent amount of people out there trying it, which is great.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I've been asking people. We just had an interview last week on, you know, the Silverlight as a design surface, and Damon Payne, you know, did this, you know, designing a stereo layout for, you know, your living room, like, you know, high def projector, you know, speaker system, surround sound. Personally, that's what he loves to do.
Right.
And I'm asking people, what's their motivation for these personal side projects? Because it's got to be interesting to you. You know, so I'll just ask you, do you find Twitter interesting?
I do. I absolutely do. With personal contacts, and especially with the kind of career I've chosen, you're going to find people that you never really would contact directly face-to-face. But we have hundreds of people out there you can talk to and get information when you need it. It's a very strong thing to be in if you're in a techie field.
Yeah, so this is my first public disclosure. This, I left Twitter.
I know.
I got social network fatigue recently, and I had to unplug. And
I saw your Twitter Free Friday post a while back.
Yeah, well, a Twitter Free Friday was started by another guy
because
you know he's trying to get microblogging to be an open platform, you know, not tied to any one vendor. I found that Twitter Free Friday was nice because I didn't run to another open microblog. I just like didn't Twitter. And I got to the point where it was like real fatigue, and I found myself like sitting on my Twitter feed, and I got tired of that. Where I really noticed it was I found myself tweeting things as opposed to blogging them. Personally, I love to blog, right? I love, you know, I went to school to be a journalist, not to be, you know, in computers and technology. And so I love to write, and that's why I left Twitter. And I want to apologize to all my friends on there. I'm not any harder to find though, because most of the people have my phone number and have my email address anyway. So I've got to do a better job of making sure that people know how to get a hold of me, like on the spur of the moment kind of thing. Because we were late starting this podcast because my train, you know, was delayed. So I was like, God, this is normally something I would tweet to Steve, but
I would have received that one. Yep.
Yeah.
Oh,
so
Twitter's worse for it, not having you.
Yeah. So, well, I do want to apologize. And this is the first time I've actually, you know, I've been meaning to write a blog article about the social network fatigue that I went through. Maybe I'll rejoin someday.
It's understandable. It's so hard to find that fine line, especially when you're working on a real project or you're interested in something else. It's so time consuming if you let it. You have to find that right balance. And, you know, when people are posting about what sandwich they ate for lunch, that kind of thing, like you've got to disconnect yourself from that and just find that these are the people that really interest me. These are the people that are kind of just noise.
There is a lot of noise out there, even people that you find interesting. Let's talk about from a technology standpoint, because before we started recording, you mentioned that, you know, the Silverlight client's not necessarily hitting the REST interfaces directly. You're actually going through an ASMX service on the back end. Can you tell us about that architectural decision and how you implemented it?
So the way Silverlight works is it can easily talk to anything served from the same port number
from the same domain.
Yeah,
right.
Sorry. So the combination of port number and domain, it's legal to talk to a service. Anything outside of that, it's going to be called a cross-domain violation, and we're going to get blocked. So when I wrote this, I hadn't heard of any news of Twitter exposing that cross-domain policy file. So it's much easier for me just to write a simple local service that's really just a wrapper of the Twitter service. So I can easily talk to my own local service asynchronously, and then it makes the actual call out to get the stream back, and then asynchronously results back to my Silverlight.
So I'll ask you if Twitter, and actually it's interesting, I coined a term called thunking, that, you know, any time to get around the cross-domain policy that you go back to your own server and that server makes a call that you would have, you know, done from the client. I actually call it web service thunking. Back to the days of, remember when we did 32-bit programming, we had to call 16-bit APIs, and it was actually, the process was called thunking.
I like it.
Yeah. So if Twitter, if you found out today, you got an email from somebody as a result of the show maybe that said, you know, hey, Twitter's actually got the cross-domain policy file now. You could do it directly. Would you refactor?
Probably not.
Probably not? Okay.
It'd be nice to know, and I definitely would probably try some new things with it. What the local service does now, and if you guys want to pull down the source code, it's all available, is that it provides a nice .NET wrapper now for the Twitter interface. So I've had a couple people take the code and write their own Twitter clients using that service. So the service is pretty simple, pretty basic, but it's nice to have.
Yeah, and we should note that the web service, you know, cross-domain policy thing is a Ajax and Silverlight specific thing. If you were to write a WPF application, it could call that other, you know, it could call the REST-based interfaces all the livelong day, and it would be, you know, nice and happy with
that's
it.
That's a good point.
You know, it's specifically, and it's there because of, you know, security concerns, you know, about, you know, cross-site scripting and things like that. If there was to be some kind of injection of code into the client because of, you know, some defensive programming that didn't take place, you know, you could potentially have sensitive information being sent to a server in Thailand, right?
Yes. So,
and that would be bad.
That would be bad. It definitely is a headache if you're doing your first Silverlight project to figure out the client access policy or the cross-domain and just see what's going on. It can be very frustrating. So tools like IE Web Developer Helper Toolbar or Fiddler, tools like that, you just need to have when you're writing this stuff.
And Firebug on Mozilla would probably give you the same information.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we do mention, you know, Firefox tools, you know, on occasion on the show. It's okay. We don't stick with just Microsoft stuff, you know.
Right. So if you're doing it for the first time, I would say, you know, you're going to suffer with the deployment a little bit. But once you get the hang of it, it's second nature. It won't hold you up anymore.
And the nice thing is with guys like you trailblazing this, you know, over the last year, when you do run into a problem, you're just a quick search away from the solution. You know, if you typed in Silverlight can't call, you know, remote web service, I'm sure you're going to get 20 good hits that explain cross-domain policy, you know, how to configure a cross-domain policy. And it's never an issue if you control the other endpoint.
It's right.
Because it's just dropping a file out, you know, on the web server that allows the access to it, and you're golden.
Right. One thing we've run into at some projects is you have to be careful. You will find the generic policy file 100 places online now. You can't just take that file and drop it, because what you've just done is expose anybody can call your service at any time. That's a right. quick fix. That's what everybody does first, is just throw it out there and, oh, it works great. But you really have to trim down that file to lock it down to this domain is okay to call, nobody else.
Right.
I thought that was interesting. That's one of the things I struggle with.
Yeah, that's a good thing to know. It is, and we as developers, you know, we tend to, like, when we're troubleshooting to get it to work, right? It used to drive me crazy where it was like, well, add the ID to the admin group. Oh, it works. Whoa, dude, come back here. So what about the admin ID is making that work? Can we just, like, add a permission to the registry, you know, for that service as opposed to giving it admin rights, you know? And, you know, my favorite one is I actually had a guy that just said, you know, oh, just make it run a system. Everything works.
Nice.
It's like, dude.
What could go wrong?
Yeah. Nothing, right? So how do you handle the fail whale? And the fail whale, if you're not familiar with Twitter, is that the picture that popped up when they had a performance issue. And they haven't solved it 100%, but the instances of the fail whale are way down compared to a year ago.
Right. Basically, our .NET wrapping service just throws back a nice pretty exception.
Okay.
That we can see what happened. And then if we, depending on what the error was, we'll either show the user, maybe your rate limit was exceeded, Twitter throttles back some of the request limits, and they can change. So that's something, if you're writing a Twitter client, you need to go out and see what the rate limit is and maybe throttle back your requests.
And what this is a performance tuning tool that they can do on their side that says, you know, the number of requests per minute you can do or per hour. I forget which one it is. But it basically says that any instance of a client or any instance of a user, you know, can only have so many requests. And that's to keep the fail whales down.
Yep.
Interesting from a UI standpoint, if you catch an error and it's not like a rate limit, you know, not a known error, but just like, whoa, you know, something happened. From a user experience standpoint, do you let the user know that, like, the data is kind of stale, you know, that it's not updating?
We basically show that there is a Twitter error. We totally pass the buck.
Okay.
If the service isn't there, there's not much we can do.
Okay.
And most people we've talked to, they really do like seeing the history of their tweets. So it's okay to me that they're sitting there. Maybe it hasn't updated for 30 seconds to a minute, but it'll keep trying. And then when Twitter comes back alive, you'll start seeing the updates again. Especially things like Barack Obama's inauguration day, things like that will just crush Twitter. So it's really interesting to see how big events like all the Apple shows and the Microsoft shows, everybody's so excited and they're so active, but all it does is it just makes large delay, and then the fail shows up sometimes.
Yeah, and it shows you that that Twitter's still heavily centered around the tech community. If
right.
Barack Obama's inauguration and the latest Apple keynote, you know, both get the same amount of traffic increase, right?
Yep.
You know, it's definitely not a broad population thing, because, you know, Obama's inauguration would absolutely crush, you know, the Apple keynote, right?
Exactly. Yep.
And, you know, or the Microsoft keynote.
My wife didn't leave CNN for 4 days with the inauguration, but she's too excited in our conferences.
Yeah, that's cool. So, from a Silverlight perspective, you know, was there anything that you ran into that you went, you know, there was a real brick wall? I mean, we talked about, you know, a couple of things, you know, thus far, like the cross-domain policy, but any other things that kind of tripped you up?
Oh, that's a good question. I think the biggest challenge, if you've seen the app, is the animating panels. That there's a lot going on behind the scenes there to get that if you resize the screen, you'll see the tweets like randomly move to new spots where they should be. And it's kind of a fun little effect we have. So we have Eric Klimczak here who's great at what he does. And so he helped come up with this. It's basically driven from panel. But if we override the arrange and the measure methods and put some nice animation effects in the code behind, you can get just amazing effects. It just boggles my mind that came from the basic panel control of the things we can do now.
Yeah, and that's absolutely, I think, the coolest thing about it is that the slider control doesn't have to look like a slider, right?
Right.
But you as a developer are still dealing with the behavior of a slider, so it's very simple to understand. Same thing with a panel and all these, you know, these great gadgets and great controls that you can make. And fundamentally, it's like, wow, that's a button, you know?
Right.
It looks like a bird, you know, that's flying, you know, when I click it, right? Yep. But it's a button.
Yep. You know, this is the whole, like, well-publicized division of, I could give this to a designer who knows XAML inside and out, and they could give me back, I could just hook up my pieces of code if I wanted to. So not in this case, because I needed to learn the blend side of it as well. I definitely had some help with the design of it, but if you wanted to work with a designer and you were just a strict C# or VB coder, no, it, those two should be able to work pretty well together now.
Yeah, and that's a good question. And maybe, you know, that should be a stock question that we have on the Thirsty Developers, that, you know, somebody who's doing SilverLight or WPF has asked them, how much time do you spend in Visual Studio versus how much time you spend in Blend? Because, you know, I'm of the mindset that even if you're just a hardcore developer, you know, you're still going to need to have Blend installed to do some things.
Yes.
And I think that, and if you're a designer, you still need Visual Studio, you know, every once in a while, right? I think the difference between the designer and the developer is the percentage of time they spend. So what percentage of time did you spend?
I spend which about tool? 10% of my time in Blend. I still have to resist the urge to change the XAML in even Notepad or Visual Studio. Like, to me, it's just, that's the way I've learned to do things, with XML or HTML, you name it, any of those markup languages. I just instantly am drawn to that. So I have to force myself to get out of that mold and get into Blend and use all the features they have. It's tough. It's tough for developers to make that switch.
So I bet in both tools, both in Blend and in Visual Studio, that you're in split view mode. Cause that's how I am, right? I need to see it. And I got to have the markup right there, right?
I have to admit that even if I'm in Blend, mostly I don't have that design view open.
Oh, okay.
It's so sad. You know?
So the tool is not built around you, right?
No, it's not at all.
Man, you're an angle bracket guy, aren't you?
But it's a powerful tool, and you know the people we've shown it to, they're so excited about what the future can bring. So just the fact that we can mock up applications now with usable actual XAML that you can turn over, and that becomes part of the project instead of I drew it up in Visio, and now somebody has to convert it into something. Or however your projects are being designed, it's really revolutionary, I think.
Yeah, it's really cutting into whiteboard sales, though, right? Because that's where we used to mock up our interface, you know, whiteboard, and then we'd go to Visio or, you know, Photoshop or whatever. And now it's almost like it's a prototyping tool. The nice thing is that you don't throw away the prototype and start from scratch, right?
Right. That's exactly right.
Yeah, well, that's what they intended, which is great. Anything else you want to talk to us about on, you know, Twitter Lite, the Twitter side of things, Silverlight?
I think this thing's going to keep evolving. It definitely changes depending on how much free time we get, just like everybody's hobby projects.
Right.
But we have some ideas we want to put in. I would love to get some search in place. I think the Twitter search stuff is coming around, and we're going to have some APIs we can hit at some point.
Yeah, actually, on the website, the Twitter search has like come a long way.
Yeah.
Because we actually had the MDC in Chicago last week, and I told everybody, you know, tag everything with #MDCChicago, you know, a hashtag. And right after the event, I was able to go search for everybody who had tagged stuff like that and get a real, you know, feel for it. That was something that was, you know, hashtags, you know, a couple of years ago were third party things. Now they're part of, you know, the actual Twitter UI,
right,
and they actually work pretty well. It'll be cool when they open that up for interesting search, right?
Yeah, they do. It's funny with the hashtags. I've heard people say that they're kind of 2007, but we still all use them. They're still, that's what they're there for. So,
well, if that's the case, what's the 2009 thing?
It's a great question. I just posted that too. I'm like, what are we supposed to be using it for? Well, I think they work. I think they do exactly what they're supposed to do.
If the search works the way it's supposed to, you shouldn't have to tag things with
right.
Pound, you know, MDC Chicago. Like when I'm on my blog writing about Silverlight, I don't tag it as #Silverlight. I just say Silverlight, right? And it figures out that it's a keyword, and then I'm pointing to the Silverlight website, and, you know, whatever.
I think it's nice though still, because you can go look on the hashtag site and just see the changes coming in, the new things. And that's a good way to find new people that are interested in what you're interested in. Where I probably wouldn't go search for something like actively run searches. But if it's a topic I care about, maybe I'll just sit and follow that for a little bit. And then the last thing I think we're going to put in at some point is kind of almost an iTunes-y cover flow effect, where we don't have 3D in Silverlight 2, but it's supposed to be on the way, right, in Silverlight 3. So we're going to try and play with...
Disclaimer, we know nothing about what's in Silverlight 3. Visit Mix.com. Definitely we're going to have some announcements around the future of Silverlight, you know, at Mix. This is a plug for Mix, which is a little less than 2 months away. The nice thing about Mix is that if you can't go to Mix, and it's so cool, you should go to Mix if you can. They stream all the keynotes live, and most of the sessions are available the next day. So
I didn't mean to throw you under the bus there.
No, it's okay.
So
I'm not allowed to say anything about the future, you know.
So regardless of if it comes or not, I think even with the RTW Silverlight 2, we're going to try and put some kind of simulated 3D effect just to make it pop a little more and give it kind of a fun scrolling feel to it. So
like the page turn application from the Silverlight 1 days, right? It was 2D, but it's like, wow, this feels kind of 3D-ish, right?
Yep. You know, throw a little trig in there. Good to go.
Actually, somebody coined the term like 2.5D. You know, that it really is 2D, right? It's X, Y. There's no Z axis on the controls, but, you know, you do some effects to make it look, you know, 3D-ish. So
I like that. Nice.
Cool. Should we wrap up?
Absolutely.
Well, Steve, thanks for being on the show. Keep chugging along, and we'll keep checking out Twitter Lite.
All right, it's an honor. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to The Thirsty Developer. This podcast is available on the Zune Marketplace and the iTunes Music Store. You can also find a link to the feed at thirstydeveloper.com. For general comments on the show or to suggest a topic, send an email to thirstydeveloper@live.com.